This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, interest rates and oil and what they can tell us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 7th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin the program today with a tale of two interest rates. The first is the federal funds rate. That's the one that gets all the attention, right? The rate that the Federal Open Market Committee sets. And you know, because you listen to this program, that that rate has been going up since March. The target is now between 3.75 and 4%. It's going up again next week. Exact increase TBD. The second rate, the average on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, which typically moves pretty much in tandem with what the Fed is doing. The key word there, though, is typically, because over the last month, the average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage has actually dropped from 7.16% all the way down, relatively speaking, to 6.4%. That's according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. And I can hear you now saying, what gives with that? Marketplace's Matt Levin gets us going.
Little multiple choice quiz for you. If the Fed raises interest rates, mortgage rates will A, go up, B, go down, or C?
It depends on what the market's outlook for the future of the economy at large is.
Karan Kaul researches housing finance at the Urban Institute, and yeah, C, that's the correct answer. The market he's talking about isn't the market for buying and selling homes. It's the market for buying and selling mortgages.
Most mortgages made in the U.S. end up being bundled and securitized into investment products.
When last month's inflation numbers came in better than expected, hedge funds and bond funds and banks across the world said, huh, maybe the Fed will slow down its rate hikes after all. So they bought a bunch of mortgages while rates were still pretty high, thinking, let's get in while homebuyers are still paying that sweet 7%. But Gina Curro at Bank of America says when there's a big surge in investor demand for mortgage bonds,
the price goes up, the rate goes down, and that trickles through to what the homeowners will see.
Now, all of a sudden, that sweet 7% drops. If the mere mention of mortgage-backed securities is giving you great recession vibes, Curro says this time really should be different.
Now, lending standards have really, really tightened.
It's an open question whether there'll be enough investor demand to keep mortgage rates down, especially because one big buyer is out of the market entirely. Joel Kahn is an economist with the Mortgage Bankers Association.
The Fed has been the largest and really the only buyer of securities for the last 2 years or so.
The Fed originally boosted its mortgage buying program after the pandemic hit. It stopped this year trying to bring down inflation, including inflation in the housing market. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
The price of a barrel of the global crude benchmark, crude oil, Brent North Sea, is below $78 today, $77.55 to be exact. That's the lowest it's been since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Perhaps related, this week the United States and its Western allies implemented that price cap on Russian oil that goes by sea that we've mentioned a couple of times on the program. $60 a barrel is the price there. Marketplace's Lily Jamali is on the correlation or causation desk today.
The price cap was designed to limit Russian oil revenues while keeping the oil itself flowing to avoid a global price shock. Oil prices, which have spiked well above $100 a barrel several times this year, have helped fund Putin's war effort, according to Eli Tesfaye, senior market strategist at RJO Futures.
Here's the thing. The world cannot end the war in Ukraine at $100 a barrel. It's impossible. So crude oil has to come down.
After debating how high to set the price cap on Russian oil, Western allies finally landed on the $60 a barrel number. That's relatively high compared to what some nations were pushing for, helping ease nerves in the marketplace, according to Ben Cahill, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Well, I think what it does signal is that it's not going to create this sort of turbulence in the market that we might have expected if the price cap was at 40.
But Cahill says just 3 days into the price cap taking effect, it's too early to tell what its impact will be. There are so many other factors pushing oil prices lower right now, from the global economic slowdown to the recent decision by OPEC Plus to keep production steady. The big wild card now will be Russia's response, says Cole Smead, president at Smead Capital Management.
Let's just theorize that this possibly does affect Putin's ability to sell oil. Well, he just won't. He'll do as much as he can to slow production,
which could lead to the same supply disruptions that the U.S. and its allies have been trying to head off. Right now, though, Putin still has plenty of other buyers for Russian oil. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I mean, I'm not in charge, but I think we're going to get a bit of a breather from the Wawas. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. I did an interview with the CEO of GoFundMe a couple of years ago, right at the early stages of the pandemic, about how people were increasingly turning to the crowdfunding platform for help as the economy came to a grinding stop. And that was before inflation became the dominant economic throughline. And now, according to a new report from the company, even more people are turning to crowdfunding for help, with significant increases and people asking for help paying for gas and groceries, baby formula, and a bunch of other basics. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Sometime this spring, Natanya Hamilton realized her paycheck just wasn't cutting it anymore.
The biggest thing was grocery. I have a 9-year-old who is almost as tall as me. He's a very big boy. And he eats.
Hamilton had been working as a physical therapist assistant in Savannah, Georgia for a few years, but she says her salary hadn't really gone up. So as prices rose,
the paycheck was just not stretching as far. I was getting less food for more money.
Then her air conditioning broke. So did her car. She started to fall behind on her mortgage and her utilities.
So it's just like these back-to-back events that, you know, without inflation would have been like a minor inconvenience, right? But with the cost of food and gas on top of everything else, turned into a thing that was kind of like could completely break me.
Eventually, Hamilton decided to put up a GoFundMe page. She called it "The Struggle and Inflation Are Real," and she asked for $2,000. She got almost all of it. She caught up on her mortgage and utilities, fixed her car, and bought some groceries.
This is a tangible reflection of the practical realities that people are struggling with.
Margaret Richardson is with GoFundMe.
We saw a 60% increase in fundraisers for gasoline. We saw a 110% increase in fundraisers for baby formula. We also saw a 10% increase in fundraisers for groceries.
Overall, GoFundMe reported that people donated more than $80 million to campaigns asking for help with those basic necessities. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
We talked on Friday about the November jobs report. 263,000 jobs added to this economy last month. And within that bigger picture, we've spent a lot of time over the years talking about how different demographic groups are doing in this recovery. Today, how people with disabilities are faring. Nicole Mastis is the director of the Retirement and Disability Research Center at the National Bureau of Economic Research. She's also a professor at Harvard. Dr. Mastis, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
What usually happens to people with disabilities? First of all, when the economy slows down, when a recession hits, what happens to it?
Usually, people with disabilities are hit the hardest. So their employment rates decline the most, and they take the longest to turn around and actually start recovering.
Give me a for instance. What did 2008 do, that recovery, which, you know, for the rest of the economy took a very long time? What did it mean for people with disabilities?
Well, for people with disabilities, their recovery lagged for a couple of years after 2008. But sometime around 2011, they started gaining ground. And actually, this was pretty important because this was the first time in decades that people with disabilities had actually seen their employment rates rise and begin to close that gap between people with and without disabilities.
Okay, so let's fast forward to today. We've just come through a pandemic, late stage, shall we say. There was the initial economic crash, I think we can safely say. What has the recovery been like for people with disabilities?
Well, two things happened. First of all, instead of people with disabilities losing more jobs than people without disabilities, they were hit about the same. So both groups lost about 10% of employment. And they recovered roughly a pace for a little while. But then at some point in the middle of 2021, so about a year in, people with disabilities saw their recovery begin to outpace the recovery of people without disabilities.
Okay, so here's the payoff pitch. Why? What happened?
So first of all, people with disabilities gained across the board, across all occupations. But where was the growth concentrated? In teleworkable occupations.
Well, say more about that. How specifically do people with disabilities have the advantage there?
Well, people with disabilities have long asked for telework as a reasonable accommodation. And, you know, before the pandemic, employers were hesitant. And then, you know, enter the pandemic.
Right.
And it turns out lots of jobs can be done from home. And sure enough, this really appears to have been kind of a silver lining of the pandemic for people with disabilities, where they have come into the labor market to take jobs, particularly as this recovery has resulted in a pretty tight labor market.
Yeah, but here's the thing. The labor market will not always stay this tight, and we don't actually know what the structural change to people going to the office or working from home will be like. So are you, as the person who studies this, are you hopeful that people with disabilities will maintain some kind of advantage in this area?
So, you know, I should say that I had been very, very worried. The gains that we saw coming out of the Great Recession really did persist. And then, you know, the pandemic hits and it's anybody's guess what's going to happen. And it's been quite remarkable, in fact, that people with disabilities have, you know, turned out to be not hit as hard and have actually seen greater improvements. So I think it's entirely possible that we could have sustained gains in the future. Some of this, of course, does depend upon what employers do.
Right.
I mean, that part, I guess, is really anybody's guess. But we now know that it can be done.
You sound pleasantly surprised.
Well, I am pleasantly surprised. I mean, I was really, really quite worried that all that gain would be just erased. We know what's happened in the past. I mean, never has there really been a recession that hasn't hit people with disabilities harder than people without disabilities. So it's quite possible that the nature of this one was such that they were able to benefit.
Dr. Nicole Mastis. She's an economist at the Harvard Medical School. Dr. Mastis, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Coming up,
I would say business right now is volatile.
The roller coaster that is holiday retail. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is basically flat today, 33,597. The NASDAQ down 56 points, about a half percent, 10,958. S&P 500 down 7 points, 0.2%, 39.33 there. Matt Levin was telling us about mortgage rates that have been dropping, so looking at some mortgage stocks, loanDepot fell 1.9% today. Invesco Mortgage Capital up almost 0.8%. Heard from Lily Jamali about the price of oil falling to its lowest point since January. So in oil stocks, Chevron grew 0.3% today. Occidental Petroleum down 0.3%. ExxonMobil down about 0.2%. Campbell Soup released earnings that were above analyst expectations. It is the maker of canned soup, but also Pepperidge Farm cookies and Cape Cod potato chips. I knew the cookies. I didn't know the chips. Campbell Soup warmed up 6% today. Get it warmed up. Competitor General Mills gained 0.2%. Kraft Heinz Company found 1.2% today. Bond prices were up. Yield on the 10-year T-note down 3.42%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. According to the Centers for Disease Control, more than 100,000 people died in this country last year from drug overdoses. 107,000, to be exact. And 75% of those deaths, the CDC says, involved an opioid. Heroin and fentanyl, right, are the best known. There is, of course, no way to calculate the emotional costs of the opioid epidemic to the lives of the addicts, their families, and their friends. But the economic cost, and this is according to the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, came to $1.5 trillion in 2020. That's added healthcare spending and lost productivity. The Biden administration is spending $1.5 billion for opioid treatment programs, one goal of which is to increase the use of medication to treat addiction. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
2 years ago, Cordray Rose was struggling with addiction.
You know, I was on the streets of Portland, homeless and using various opiates and also methamphetamines, and eventually opiates took over my life.
The 28-year-old recently attended a celebration of Oregon's recovery community. He works for a peer support group.
I think one of the things that helped me the most in my recovery was medically assisted treatment.
In other words, using prescription drugs to help opioid addicts deal with cravings and withdrawal and live normal lives.
It just completely changed the game for me. It's made it to where I can hold down my job. I've worked at my job for over 2 years now, as long as I've ever kept a job.
The FDA has approved 3 medications for treating opioid addiction. And Dr. Rahul Gupta, director of the White House Office of National Drug Policy, recently told the New England Journal of Medicine they work.
When we use these medications, we have people much less likely, in fact, 82% less likely to die from an overdose.
Great for the nearly 8 million Americans, Gupta says, are experiencing opioid use disorder right now, but
only less than 5% of those individuals are able to get treatment today as it stands.
The Biden administration wants universal access in 3 years by reducing barriers to prescribing and dispensing these medications, and there are plenty of those. Doctors and clinics need a federal waiver to prescribe the addiction drug buprenorphine. The DEA keeps tight control of treatment centers that dispense methadone. And many states and localities restrict where treatment can be delivered and how it can be funded. In West Virginia, for example, with the highest overdose death rate in the country, there's a moratorium on opening any new opioid treatment programs.
It does sometimes feel like we're banging our head up against a wall, right?
Lee Storo with the Community Education Group has been lobbying the West Virginia legislature to lift the moratorium.
It is no secret that the opioid epidemic has hit West Virginia really hard. And the tool that we know, decades of research have shown methadone to be safe and effective in reducing drug use. We cannot have a new provider open.
Making more medication treatment available means making it easier for doctors to prescribe, says Dr. Jean Marie Perron at the Penn Center for Addiction Medicine and Policy. Expanding telehealth to reach people in rural areas would also help. And Perron says it should be easier for patients to stay in treatment even if they don't pass drug tests or attend counseling sessions.
You know, counseling can be a big burden. A lot of opioid treatment programs require patients to come in 3 days a week for a group. And on top of coming in every day to get your methadone, that's not conducive to working and having a family.
But expanding access to medication without other mental health supports isn't likely to work, says Dr. Nasser Khan. He supervises a chain of opioid treatment centers around the country. And while he agrees getting more people on medication is crucial to preventing overdoses,
medication alone doesn't teach patients new strategies. It doesn't help them build new peer groups, critically examine their behavioral patterns.
One measure to expand care is getting traction nationwide, taking opioid treatment on the road.
This one is actually going out to our Hillsborough.
One of the treatment centers Khan oversees in Portland, Oregon, just got a customized medical van. These are now permitted under DEA regulations.
It's unacceptable that people that are trying to turn around their lives are forced to commute upwards of an hour to be able to get a life-sustaining treatment. By putting a mobile van in the community, now I'm able to treat people.
Khan says it's a good start. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On the economic calendar, the rest of this week and next, come Friday, we'll get the University of Michigan's regular read on consumer sentiment. Then next week comes the Consumer Price Index, then the Fed's press conference, and Thursday, November's retail sales report, with which we'll get a better picture of how the American consumer is shopping this holiday season. Before all of that, though, over the next couple of days, we'll get the view from the other side of the cash register, the small business side of the story. And up first, a random stroll near the Appalachian Trail.
My name is Eric Champlin. I'm co-owner of Trailful Outdoor Co. in Hiawassee, Georgia, with my husband, Rob Soli. Trailful is a hiking, backpacking, and trail running store. We sell everything from footwear to apparel to gear. We're actually located in a small town near the Appalachian Trail in the North Georgia Mountains. Typically in November and December, we do see fewer hikers out on the trail. We do have the benefit of being in a tourist town. It's kind of a destination for especially some of the bigger metro areas around us. I would say business right now is volatile. We might have a very slow Saturday morning when those are typically really busy, and that might be followed by an extremely busy Sunday afternoon when those are typically a lighter day. In general, we're just probably overstaffed at this point, just preparing for that inevitable surge of, shoppers on a random Tuesday afternoon that we usually don't see it. So that's definitely been a challenge with staffing as well. It's been an interesting 6 months for sure, because I think we've seen most of the brands and suppliers go from extremely delayed orders to really catching up in the past 6 months. But that's created a tidal wave of inventory incoming. And the consumer buying patterns are definitely shifting. Just even our own branded t-shirts were a huge source of revenue for us in years past. We've seen a lot of our shoppers kind of passing up even great sales on branded t-shirts and gifts. And instead they're going for things that are more useful and durable, like a backpack or a tent. We're basically ending the year with probably about 30 to 40% more inventory than we would like to. I think we would love to see both an increase in foot traffic and just an increase in, shopping in general. It would be nice to kind of clear out some of this year's inventory just to make room for what's coming up next for next year. I think as a small business owner, and especially as a small business owner couple, it's hard to turn off the business, especially when it's something that you love, that you're passionate about. That does lead to plenty of breakfast time conversations about analytics and numbers and staffing and all of those good things. And it doesn't quite seem like work most of the time. It's something that we love to do, so I don't think either one of us mind it too much.
Eric Champlin there. He's the co-owner of Trailful Outdoor Co. They're in Hiawassee, Georgia. This final note on the way out today, we have come to that time of year where we get all the year-end lists, and I saw this in the Washington Post today. It's from the Google Trends Year in Search thing that the company does every year. The most searched terms of 2022. Starting from number five, working our way up, Bob Saget. Number four, Queen Elizabeth. Number three, Betty White. Number two, election results. Number one, which makes me despair just a tiny little bit, Wordle. All right, here's your moment of economic context. Just want to follow up on Lily Jamali's piece on oil prices. It ought to be noted that crude is now $50 below, $50 below where it was at its high this year, which is good, yes. Cheaper gas and home heating oil, right? I am required, though, to point out here that falling oil prices are usually a sign of falling demand. A falling demand can in turn be a sign of a slowing economy. So, you know, caveat emptor, I guess. You know what I mean. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.